Before we begin to understand the relationship between socialism and ethics, we need to acquaint ourselves with the ethics of capitalism. One does not have to look very far to encounter the practical morality of the present social system. You only have to go to the prisons where those who transgress against the dictatorship of property are thrown into human scrapyards of brutality and isolation to see how the ethics of profit are maintained. Or look at the police cells where the point of morality is conveyed via the boot of the law enforcer, and you will see how capitalism persuades its moral nonconformists into the ways of goodness. Or go to the schools where a new generation of children is being mentally polluted because the needs of capital require economic and emotional servility and repression from its future wage slaves. Go to those places where millions are starving amidst mountains of food while Christian preachers tell them that they are selfish and greedy. The moral apologists for capitalism have plenty to say, but I would argue nothing worth listening to. Their principles of social conduct are the principles of undisturbed capitalist conduct. They self-righteously deprecate the Auschwitzes and the Dachau's while justifying the Long Keshes and the Wormwood Scrubs. They deplore the sexual promiscuity of the young while the profit system turns human desires into commodity relationships to be regulated by the commercial dictates of fashion and to be satisfied only through the marketplace. They are revolted by the idea of women selling their bodies to men, which amongst the morally decent is supposed to be done as a wholesale transaction by the legal means of a marriage contract. But if workers did not sell the power of their bodies to capitalists, which is a highly moral form of prostitution from the angle of the exploiter, the entire profit system would cease to function. They indignantly moralise against the violence of those who should be putting their energies to more exploitable use, but the ethics of mass slaughter by the weaponry of the state is manifested by the award of medals to the legal perpetrators of international destruction. The cries of indignation with which capitalism's moralists respond to the unfortunate worker who is caught stealing back some of the wealth which he has produced is only balanced by the cries of moral sanctification with which the legalised robbery of the wages system is praised as being the highest form of economic benevolence. So the sweet-smelling morality of capitalism does not in any way serve to hide the foul stench of a system in which the privileged few can only perpetuate themselves and their positions of authority by means of the parasitic destruction of the feelings and the hopes and the potentialities of the class which is compelled to labour because it does not own. The ethics of capitalism echo in every sense the needs of capital. They can never do other than that. The ethics of any age reflect the class needs of those who dominate the age. It's a fundamental principle of Marxism that the struggle against capitalism is not a conflict between competing abstract images of how society ought to be, but is an historically determined part of the process of humanity bringing its social relations into line with the productive forces. The young Hegelians in the Germany of the 1830s represented the conventional progressive standpoint of seeking a better society by means of ethical regeneration. For them, social transformation depended upon people freeing themselves from their false ideas. Marx recognised quite correctly that this approach simply amounted to attacking the shadow in the hope that the body would therefore be destroyed. In Britain, in the mid-19th century, there was a good deal of this kind of shadow chasing going on, mainly by well-intentioned critics of the new industrial system, who were largely from the higher and more privileged sections of society, and who felt ethically out of harmony with the new ways of living which the Industrial Revolution had brought with it. Marx criticises these idealist critics of industrial capitalism, whom he refers to as feudal socialists. He criticises them with considerable wit, if not a somewhat undue harshness. And he refers to their social criticism as being, I quote, half lamentation, half lampoon, half echo of the past, half menace of the future, at times by its bitter, witty and incisive criticism, striking the capitalist class to the very heart's core, but always ludicrous in its effect, through total incapacity to comprehend the march of modern history. The unhistorical nature of this criticism did not weaken the passion and the ability with which it was stated. The two most able spokesmen of the so-called romantic revolt against industrialism in Britain were Thomas Carlyle and John Ruskin. Carlyle was offended by the tendency within industrial capitalism to reduce all values to what he called the cash nexus. In 1843, Carlyle wrote a very important book, Past and Present, in which he described the alienation of capitalism in terms which were not that different from those used by Marx in his Paris manuscripts written a year later. To quote from it, Carlyle writes, "We call it a society and go about professing openly the totalist separation and isolation. Our life is not a mutual helpfulness, but rather cloaked under the due laws of war named fair competition. It is a mutual hostility. We have profoundly forgotten everywhere that cash payment is not the sole relation of human beings." Similarly, Ruskin was as passionate and as clear in attacking the contradictions of this new industrial society. His most important work, The Stones of Venice, he remarks how capitalism can, I quote, "manufacture everything except men. We blanch cotton and strengthen steel and refine sugar and shape pottery, but to brighten, to strengthen, to refine, or to form a single living spirit never enters into our estimate of advantages." So it was out of this movement of romanticism, of idealism, of passionate moral indignation, that the revival of the idea of socialism emerged in Britain in the late 1870s. The most prominent philosopher of the new Marxist movement, which took form in the 1880s, was Ernest Belfort Bax. Bax became a socialist in 1871, at the age of 16, upon reading accounts of the slaughter of the 30,000 communards in Paris. In 1875, he went to Stuttgart to study music, and this enabled him to make contact with European Marxists. His studies of German philosophy led him to read Marx's Capital, and Bax, in fact, published an article on Marx's ideas in a British journal which was called Modern Thought. And Marx regarded Bax's exposition of Marxism as being, I quote, "the first English publication of the kind which is pervaded by a real enthusiasm for the new ideas themselves and boldly stands up against British Philistinism." And between 1885 and 1895, Bax was undoubtedly, including Morris, the most important writer of the Marxist movement in relation to philosophical and dialectical thought. During that period, he wrote 8 books, he wrote over 50 articles in socialist journals, and he wrote a number of other writings in collaboration with William Morris. He was a regular contributor to the Socialist League journal Commonweal, and also a prominent speaker. Bax's 2 major essay collections, The Religion of Socialism and the ethics of socialism contain a mixture of the most readable materialist insights of the period, together with a number of writings which bear the hallmarks of the Romantic Revolt, which is still stuck to some extent in those ethical frameworks, together, of course, with a few essays which must be entirely dismissed as being eccentric wanderings of an active mind, in particular perhaps his writings on the question of the equality of the sexes can certainly be dismissed in that way. Bax was the first Marxist to concentrate on the subject of ethics. Marx had started by stating that morality was no more than a superstructural reflection of the economic material base. In fact, Marx didn't see this as being a direct mechanistic reflection, that here you have the economic system and here you have a simple reflection of ideas. He, in fact, used a word which meant a mirroring in a broad sense of following through the economic tendencies within the area of thought. The ruling ideas of any society, according to Marx, are always the ideas which are in the interests of the ruling class. The ruling class being the class which owns and controls the means of producing and distributing wealth. Marx described his own social theory as being scientific rather than moralistic. His collaborator Engels actually argued that Marx was the Darwin of social science, a claim which can be extended too far either way, but nevertheless, this was a scientific approach which Marx saw himself as taking. Material factors, rather than their ethical reflections, are the stuff from which real history is made, according to Marx. To quote him, "Communists preach no morality at all." He wrote this in The Poverty of Philosophy. "Socialists, according to Marx, make no normative judgments. That is to say, they make no statements about how things ought to be. The scientific socialist's concern is with the course of history in line with the scientifically perceived laws of social motion. No more and no less." And that, in brief, is the claim of Marxism as being beyond ethics, as being scientific. And it is this claim which I intend to examine in this lecture. Let's first consider the arguments put by those who deny the scientific and non-ethical basis of the case for socialism. Emil Durkheim certainly rejected the scientific claim of Marx's writing. He wrote, "What gave birth to them and constitutes their strength is the thirst for a more perfect justice. Socialism is not a science, it is a cry of pain." An eminent writer within the Yugoslav Praxis group wrote in 1975, shortly before that group was banned in Yugoslavia and its leading members were imprisoned, he wrote that, I quote, "Marxism is a body of thought which is uncompromising in its rejection of all forms of human alienation, exploitation, oppression, and injustice, regardless of the type of society, capitalist or socialist, in which these phenomena occur. According to these thinkers, socialism is no less an ethical proposition than any other political or social proposition would be. The fact that socialists do not remain mechanistically indifferent to the coming of the next historical stage, but we actually want it to come about, we like the idea of free access and equality and peace and so on, that makes socialism an ethical case. They would say that Marx was kidding himself when he claimed to be expounding an amoral scientific theory. They would say that the Marxists of the 1880s were arrogant when they assumed that their opposition to capitalism was scientific, whereas the early Romantic Revolt was of a less serious, merely ethical nature. And as far as the Socialist Party of Great Britain is concerned, far from being the bringers of the objective laws of social evolution to the working class, as we think we are in fact just another band of thinkers who have a good idea about how society ought to be. That is what the critics of this position would say. And we may indeed have a very good idea, they would say, but socialism, even if it is a better idea than capitalism, can only be proposed as a superior ethical alternative, because it presupposes a choice. Well, that is the reverse claim to the one put by scientific socialists, including Marx. If Marxists are to retain scientific credibility, if they are to continue calling themselves, or we are to continue calling ourselves, scientific socialists, then Marxism has to answer the suggestion that it is an ethical theory. Now, the best way for me to demonstrate that Marxism is not a morality or a theory of ethics, and that socialism is not, in ethical terms, simply a good idea, is by following through some of the most common ethical arguments which are described as being socialist or socialistic. We shall see that without materialism, the case for socialism is superficially an attractive one, but politically a quite meaningless one. Now, with the help of Bax's writings, let me deal with three of these ethical approaches. Firstly, there is the ethical condemnation of capitalism. They would argue, the critics of Marx as a science, that you can only condemn the system on ethical grounds. Secondly, there is the case for a just society. They would argue, the critics of Marxism as a science, that socialism is proposed because it is just. Thirdly, there is the ethics of choice. Again, those who would argue that Marxism is not a science would argue that wherever there is a choice to be made, ethical theory has to be brought into it. The ethical condemnation of capitalism is no new phenomenon on the British left. For as long as this particular form of exploitation and oppression has existed, there have been people who have said that it is evil, that it is somehow iniquitous, that it is morally to be condemned. Now, superficially, one would not wish to argue against people who say this. When radical vicars sermonise about the iniquities of mass starvation and concerned labourites say that nuclear bombs are morally obscene, we may well nod along, as one does to an old familiar tune. And nodding to the ethical tune is probably an important initial stage in becoming a socialist. I'll come on to that relationship between this gut feeling of opposition to a capitalist way of life and the rational understanding a little later. But the ethical critique of the system, when pursued as a political end in itself, has certain mistaken assumptions. The most mistaken of them is to see social affairs in terms of the moral culpability of the participants. The capitalist class as exploiters, oppressors, and parasites are condemned as being evil, greedy, immoral people. The superficial fact that this is often true should not blind us to the more important social observation that even if the capitalists were the most well-intentioned, selfless, sociable people, as of course a few black sheep among them are, that would not for a moment alter the oppressive, exploitative, parasitical nature of their class position. A capitalist who ceased to indulge in the exploitation of his workforce would soon become a wage slave himself. Now, Bax had nothing but contempt for those wealthy young radicals of his day who thought that it was morally more decent to live in poverty than to accept the privileges of their class position. This is how Bax put it, a good half century, incidentally, before Paul Foot and certain other well-off radicals were gassing their moralistic sentiments in the name of socialism.
With the sentimental or semi-sentimental socialism of the middle classes, there is mingled a good deal of half-unconscious cant. There is a sort of feeling that poverty, squalor, and coarseness are in themselves sacred. And the good young man, who instead of joining the YMCA takes to studying social questions, seems to think it incumbent on him to develop a taste for sordid habits and surroundings. A worthy person with aspects of spotless cleanliness and refinement was heard to exclaim recently in a moment of wild enthusiasm, that he had rather sleep in a bed infested by noisome insects than eat and drink the wedding breakfast of a baronet. Now, this sentiment, it seems to me, is more fitting in the mouth of a retired bacon factor turned vestryman and presiding at a soup kitchen, who wants to keep the poor contented with their lot, rather than in that of a socialist. Beds, as above, are within the reach of all, even the poorest of our brethren, but baronets' breakfasts are certainly not within the reach of all. Now, if the beds in question are better than the baronet's breakfast, wherefore do we seek economic reconstruction? The present system supplies even the reserve army of industry with beds of this description upon demand at the casual war, and does not trouble them with Yorkshire hams, cold fowl and champagne, but gives them rather meat and drink in keeping with the beds. So on the whole, we live under the best possible of systems in the best possible of worlds. I had always thought socialists wanted to bring the baronet's breakfast within the reach of all, and only leave enough frowsy beds to supply the wants of eccentric persons like our friend. Again, I know of a young man who thinks it an act of socialistic virtue, not an unfortunate necessity, mind, to live on 15 shillings a week with wife and children. He started with the view of proving that, after all, money is rather an encumbrance than otherwise to noble aspirations. Now, I really think this young man ought to be decorated by Baron Rothschild or the Liberty and Property Defence League. If he could prove his thesis, no more crushing argument could be brought against those who doubt the perfection of the present system to satisfy all human requirements. Others, again, pretend to like dropping H's, a vile, cockney corruption of language having only an incidental connection with distinctions between classes. Dirty hands, and uncomfortable third-class carriages, and many other nasty things, and all because of socialism. This is very silly, perhaps, but more or less harmless. When, however, middle-class young men take to virtuously entering an already overstocked labour market, and thus doing the proletarian in more than one sense, the same cannot be said. It is surprising that these essentially individualist and bourgeois notions of the superiority of poverty and squalor and of the virtue of self-mortification for the mere sake of it and without any ulterior social object, which are radically inconsistent with socialism, could ever come to be regarded as having any part or lot with socialism, the end and aim of which is to abolish all these things.
Well, you've all, no doubt, met the self-styled radical who tells you that Margaret Thatcher is a monster and Reagan's nuclear bombs are obscene and the luxury of private hospital beds are morally indefensible. Now, I would say, by all means, give these people a nod and a smile. That's probably all that they want. But in terms of understanding the problem, what can be the ethical conclusion of all this, except that those who act badly should act well? What, in other words, can be the conclusion of this kind of an ethical critique, except to say to people that you're calling upon people who at the moment are living lives of luxury, at the moment are carrying out the necessities of their class position, to stop doing that and to act in the interests of the class which they're currently exploiting? Another aspect of the attitude I've described is the notion that the class which is oppressed and exploited are the salt of the earth. This is a kind of a patronising attitude all too common on the British left of the good old working class who are the salt of the earth. This is a certain kind of radical mythology which has emerged out of the ethical critique of capitalism and which assumes that there's something intrinsically decent about the working class. According to this belief, if only the banks were run by dockers and prisons were run by nurses and all police inspectors were people who had been recruited from the worst council estates in London, the evil society of the present would be transformed into a humanised form of capitalism. Bats, again with a certain amount of wit and ability, deals with this argument.
It will be observed that I make no distinction here in favour of the working class as such. Many people are apt to think of the new society as essentially the same as the present, only with the relative positions of classes changed. They have a confused notion of the gentle stockbroker being bullied by the coarse and brutal factory hand. They cannot realise that under a developed socialistic system, the workman type of today and the middle class type of today will be alike as extinct as the dodo. Out of the changed conditions, a new type must necessarily arise, differing from any of those at present existing. For these all presuppose class conditions. All class character as class character is bad. Were the working man any more than the middle class man an angel, socialism would be unnecessary. Socialists who recognise individual character to be the child of social conditions could not expect a class degraded materially to the condition of proletarianism not to bear the mark of this degradation on the character of its members.
To ethically criticise capitalism is to condemn it with its own weapons. As I said, there is some superficial attraction in any kind of ethical criticism of capitalism, just as there is a superficial satisfaction in exposing to the congregation that the vicar was recently seen with a prostitute in King's Cross. But of course, capitalism can only survive by hypocritically breaching and updating its own ethics. A capitalist class couldn't possibly continue in that position of privilege without breaking the rules which they set for other people and even to some extent for themselves. But even if it did not break its own rules, the fact that its shadow was in direct line with the system it is shadowing does not in any way resolve the contradictions within the capitalist system itself. Even if every capitalist acted and exploited the working class with the utmost morality and purity, that would not for a second deny the existence of the exploitative process. There is an ethical response to what I have just said, and it neatly leads us on to the second ethical argument which I said I would deal with. This is the proposition that socialism equals justice. According to such an argument, capitalism is unjust because it deprives workers of the fruits of their labour, it allows a minority to have unearned privilege, and it is profoundly uncaring. Socialism, on the other hand, will be just because everyone will enjoy the fruits of social labour, there will be equality, it will be a caring society. Now, again, superficially, we can have no quarrel with this, and everyone can nod their heads in the time-honoured fashion. But then I put this argument. What do you mean when you refer to justice, to capitalism being unjust, to socialism being just? According to Lord Denning, who is a capitalist expert on justice, of course, it is quite just to extract surplus value from a class which is economically compelled to let itself be robbed, but it is most unjust for a hungry person to take an apple from a shop, or for a worker in a bakery to take home a loaf of bread which he spent his day making. Obviously, say our ethical critics, we do not approve of Lord Denning's ethics. Indeed, they would go as far as to say Lord Denning's ethics are unethical in themselves. Now, unless I am mistaken, the only way in which one can expound a superior morality is by having an absolute concept of what is right and what is wrong. In other words, you've got to be able to say, my ethics are better than yours because I have something absolute about my ethics, something unchanging, something which will always make them right and always make them wrong, which is contained within them. Now, of course, Lord Denning would, and in fact does, vigorously assert that his concepts of right and wrong are unchanging and absolute. He has written quite widely and would speak quite frequently about his ethics and his laws being based upon the natural law, the absolute law. But we can look at this problem of absolute justice from an historical angle.
in late feudal society, the rising capitalists resented the fact that the new productive forces of capital had to comply with the political customs of the feudal state. So a part of the capitalists' rent, interest and profit in late feudal society was channeled into feudal obligations to the economically parasitical aristocracy. The emergent capitalists understandably protested against this. It is unjust, they said, that individual entrepreneurs should have to submit to those who possess political but not economic power. And philosophers like Locke argued that it was just for a capitalist to retain the fruits of his own production. He argued that you shouldn't have any obligation to a feudal state, to landlords, to aristocrats, but only to those who actually controlled and owned the means of production, the means of production being capital. In short, capitalist justice was a class need, just as feudal justice had been a class need. As soon as two moral concepts face one another, aristocratic justice versus capitalist justice versus proletarian justice, it is clear that the moral is not absolute, but relative to the class interests of the moralists in question. In other words, that the term justice itself is an unnecessary term. What you are really dealing with is one class interest versus another one, that interest being dressed up in the guise of a concept of justice. Balfour backs, by applying the analysis of history, very adequately explains this point, that justice is an historically formed concept arising out of the developing class needs of different classes throughout history. And here is what Bax has to say on the point.
It is just, says the individualist, for a man to be able to do what he likes with his own. Good. But what is his own? The own of the Roman citizen of the Republic included his slaves. These he could cut up to feed his fish, if he liked. And he doubtless felt it unjust when the emperors limited his right to the control of his own property, in this and similar ways, by sundry enactments which, to employ a modern phrase, savoured of state socialism. Again, the donkey is the costermonger's own. But if the costermonger stimulates the donkey's flagging energies with a two-pronged fork, the modern state interferes and limits the control of the costermonger over his property. The costermonger perhaps thinks it unjust, the state socialistic and the like. The humanitarian thinks it just, and is so far untrue to bourgeois principles. But, says the bourgeois advocate, this does not touch us. We only refer to the things which are products of industry, and which can be, and have been, lawfully acquired. Now, the right to property in human flesh is not admitted in the present day in any sense, and therefore it cannot be lawfully acquired. The property in asinine or other flesh is admitted only with certain restrictions. Have a care, O bourgeois. You conceive, then, that the concepts of right and justice as regards property have changed, for it was not always so. But no matter. It is just, you say, for a man to possess the product of his industry, or what he has acquired in a lawful manner, and to have the entire control of it. Good. But the feudal baron would not have thought it just to have been deprived of his dues taken from the industry of his villages, whom he had acquired with his lands, lands obtained not by industry, but by violence. At the sack of a town, the medieval knight would have thought it unjust had his lord, in accordance with 19th century notions of equity, magnanimously compelled him to surrender his booty to its original lawful owner. And the rest of the world would have agreed with him, owner included. But these were bad men, you will say. And it is true that the principle of your middle-class conception of justice is opposed to the justice of these men. Therefore, to you, they are bad.
Now, there are certain ethical students of Marxism, students of society who are only capable, one might think, of judging political theories in moral terms, a number of whom happen, as a matter of fact, to be American professors of philosophy, who become most distraught when they are confronted by Marx's moral relativism, when they actually find out that Marx was not criticising capitalism or proposing socialism in a moral or ethical sense. This causes them to become rather indignant. Nowhere in his writings does Marx say that capitalism is unjust or that socialism would be just. For example, the following passage by Marx in volume 3 of Capital explicitly accepts that capitalism is, on its own class terms, and that is the only way you can ever examine a theory of ethics, on its own class terms, capitalism is a just society.
The justice of transactions which go on between agents of production rests on the fact that these transactions arise as natural consequences from the relations of production. The juristic forms in which these economic transactions appear as voluntary actions of the participants cannot, being mere forms, determine this content. They merely express it. This content is just whenever it corresponds to the mode of production. It is unjust whenever it contradicts that mode. Slavery on the basis of the capitalist mode of production is unjust. So is fraud in the quality of commodities.
Now, this refusal to engage in the justice game has so incensed certain American philosophers, and in particular I refer to a certain George G. Brenkert, who is unfortunate enough to be a philosopher specialising in Marxist ethics at the University of Tennessee. It has so incensed Professor Brenkert that the poor, bewildered fellow has been driven to write that,
when Marx speaks of the exploitation of the worker, he does not use exploit to connote an instance of injustice. If exploitation does not connote injustice, then what does it mean? What is all this Marxist fuss about? Insofar as the word exploitation carries a negative moral connotation, I suggest that it relates to the lack of freedom which the worker experiences.
So, as Engels rightly states, I quote, "The conception of eternal justice belongs among those things by which everyone understands something different." In other words, what is economic order for the capitalist minority is market anarchy for the wealth-producing majority. Freedom for us means the loss of the liberty to live on our backs for them. Socialist harmony for one class equals chaos for the present ruling class. These antagonisms are not of an ethical or judicial nature. They are determined by material class interests. Socialism will no more create justice than it will destroy injustice. Indeed, socialism will, in one sense, destroy justice, in that it will destroy capitalist justice, the justice of exploitation. The new society will be neither a good nor a bad society in absolute terms. For the millions who are currently starving, production for use will be good, not in an ethical, philosophical sense, but in a material one. It will take away the obstacle that stands between those who need food and those who own it. But for the investors in food manufacturing production, production for use will be economically disadvantageous in material terms, because it will end the state of affairs where they can grow rich while people starve to death. In that sense, the eradication of mass starvation will be materially bad for them. So, production for use is not an ethical aspiration. It's not a vision of how society ought to be. In its materialist application, production for use is a class interest which exists in material antagonism to the need for production for profit, which is the class interest, not the ethical interest, of the present ruling class. Now, this is not mere philosophical hair splitting. Of course, in one sense, it does not matter whether socialism is regarded as an ethical proposition or a class interest. It doesn't matter at all. In one sense, all that matters is that people prefer socialism to capitalism. But history is not made by ethical preferences. The struggles of the past have not been between rival moralities. To assume that history is made by such ethical struggles would be to commit the idealistic fallacy of those writers of the mid-19th century who were part of the Romantic Revolt, of those earlier Hegelian writers who assumed that the great struggle in history was not between material class interests, but between ideals. No, history is made by the material struggle for existence between classes. The movement for socialism is the movement of the class interests of the working class. The expressions of this movement may occasionally take an ethical form, but ultimately, such ethical forms will only serve to mystify the material factors which are involved. In other words, those people who do attempt to advocate the case for socialism in terms of justice and ethical superiority of socialism are ultimately mystifying the real class factors which the struggle for socialism is all about. This brings me to the third ethical argument against the Marxist claim to be a science. And I could refer to something which is a bit closer to home. At the end of last year, I wrote an article in the Socialist Standard in which I argued, exactly as I've argued in this lecture, that the case for socialism is based upon class and not ethical interests. A reply to that article was sent by a well-known French professor who claims to be an expert on Marxism, written a number of books by the names of Roubel. His argument was to say that, firstly, the recognition of a class interest is necessarily an ethical action, as is any action which allows a choice between A or B. Anything which presupposes that there is a choice, even the recognition of your own self-interest, class interest, that is an ethical choice. And secondly, that as all previous class movements have adopted their own theory of ethics, so should socialism. Now, this seems to be a reasonable criticism of the Marxist claim to be scientific, and therefore it needs to be answered. To begin with, we can say one thing, that not all choices between competing possible actions are ethical choices. That is nonsense. Whether, for example, I have a pint of lager or a lemonade after this lecture is a choice, but it has absolutely nothing to do with ethics. Unless, of course, I find myself under pressure in the bar from the Salvation Army. So it's not an ethical choice. It is, of course, a material one. If I buy the drink, it will be a lemonade. If one of you buys it, it will probably be a pint of lager. So it's a material choice. It is based upon not a theory of ethics, which I have, a theory of what is good and what is bad, what is right and what is wrong. It has nothing to do with philosophical absolutes. It is a material choice relating to my own thirst, which is a manifestation of my own biological condition. Now, according to the professor, the choice between accepting exploitation and rejecting it is an ethical one. If one was a detached onlooker upon the exploitation process, I would agree that one's views of exploitation would largely be left to ethical consideration. But the working class, which is the class which must be the historical agent for the creation of socialism, is not in any sense objective in its examination of the exploitation of the wages system. For workers who accept the capitalist interest on exploitation, which is of course unfortunately a majority at present, for them the privilege of being employed for wages is in their own interest. But for workers who see exploitation from the viewpoint of their own class interest, they do not oppose the wages system as an objective evil, but do so because they are the exploited class. In other words, it is not an ethical, onlooking point of view, it is a participative, experiential point of view. It is actually from the scene of exploitation that the working class interest is to oppose that exploitation from the angle of experience and not observation. There has never been, of course, a movement of exploiters who have united together to put an end to any form of exploitation. This is not because of some kind of moral blindness on the part of exploiters, but because material class interests are the basis of decisions and not ethics. The people who oppose the present system of exploitation, oppression, and poverty are those who have experienced these things. Opposition arises out of the class experience of these factors and not the ethical contemplation of these factors. So people who have become socialists have not become socialists as a consequence of special ethical feeling, but as a result of a material interest showing them what they have to do, showing them what alternative is necessary. Now, of course, a pedantic philosopher could argue, because this French professor was such a pedantic philosopher, he argued that it is an ethical choice whether you prefer not to be exploited or whether you prefer to be exploited. Now, if of course, and he actually argues this point, if of course the working class was a class of masochists, if the working class was a class which actually preferred to do what was disadvantageous to its own experience rather than what was beneficial to its own experience, then material development would not take place. And of course, by and large, material survival is a driving force in history. The desire for comfort, the desire for advancement, the desire for some kind of control over one's own destiny, that is a material generator of historical change. Those who mistakenly think that material needs are merely a matter of choice, then in other words, there are something called abstract wants, which are freely determined by the individual outside of his or her material existence, what they are failing to do is to understand the social nature of ideas and actions. We think about, we want, we need those things which our conditioning makes us think about and want and need. And the need for socialism on the part of the exploited is as material as the need for food on the part of the hungry. We would not, of course, take kindly to a French philosopher who told us that hunger is an ethical choice on the part of the unfed. In precisely the same way, opposition to exploitation, the desire for social freedom, that is not an ethical choice on behalf of the exploited. Now, the claim that socialism must have its own alternative set of ethics to those of the system it intends to displace is based upon an historical misunderstanding about the reason for and the origin of morals and ethics. Belfort Bax's study of the history of ethics, which is to be found in his major essay, The New Ethic, explains that ethical ideas arose as a product of human alienation in primitive communist society. In other words, in the thousands of years which preceded the origin of private property, human beings expressed their individuality in no other way than by existing socially. The principles of individual existence and of social existence coincided. People lived as individuals for society, they lived socially for the individuals within society. And the manifestation of the self was through the social whole. The emergence of property and the alienation of the individual from the social function, in other words, from the means of production, this led to a conflict between the individual and his society. And this conflict made it so that society appeared as an external, uncontrollable abstraction above and beyond the human parts which made up that society. Ethics are, in fact, the code words of alienated existence, where there is this division between the individuals in society and the society which is beyond their grasp. There has to be a way of manipulating the individual into the class needs of that social formation. Ethics are the means of manipulating the dispossessed in the class interest of the property owners and controllers. And it is only as long as there is this dislocation between the individual and society that ethical manipulation is necessary. The dialectical task of Marxism and of socialism is to put the alienated pieces back together, to return the individual to society, and equally, and just as importantly, to return society to the individual. As Marx put this in his Paris Manuscripts of 1844, and I quote, "What is to be avoided above all else is the re-establishing of society as an abstraction vis-à-vis the individual. The individual is the social being." So, socialism needs no ethical theory because, firstly, it is a class movement which exists not to put a new class in control of society and to manipulate other classes into its own interests, but to, in fact, end classes, to end class interests as such. And secondly, its dialectical purpose is to end the primary moral, ethical problem of how the individual relates to society by synthesizing the existence of the social individual with that of the individual society. Well, let me conclude now by making 3 points about the relationship between socialism and ethics. Firstly, socialists do have a relationship to ethics. Socialists have a negative attitude towards ethics. The rejection of capitalist morality is often the first step towards socialist consciousness. And Frederick Engels, in fact, explains this in his important work, Anti-Jury. He writes, "All moral theories have been hitherto the product, in the last analysis, of the economic conditions of society obtaining at the time. And as society has hitherto moved in class antagonisms, morality has always been class morality. It has either justified domination and interest of the ruling class, or, ever since the oppressed class became powerful enough, it has represented its indignation against the domination and the future interests of the oppressed." So, whilst Marxists preach no morality, we do indeed recognise that there is a moral struggle to be waged. The weakening grip of capitalist morality upon working class minds, and especially those of the young, is of great political importance to us. Indeed, they're a great political worry to the ruling class, for whom maths, ethical conditioning is a source of great social strength. The second point I want to make in conclusion is in relation to the understandable fear on the part of many people that the objective of an amoral society, a society without concepts of right, wrong, good or bad, is bound to equal an immoral social theory, a theory of society where the consideration of people, considerations which are normally connected with the highest ideals of morality, will not exist. And of course, many of such thinkers, including the Praxis group in Yugoslavia, have pointed to Russia and its empire as an example of an ethically bankrupt society. Not a society which has rejected morality, but a society which has retained a bankrupt morality. And of course, what we can say in conclusion, and this is my third and concluding point, is that socialism seeks to put an end to the individualism which requires ethical defence for one group against another in society, one class against another, and it seeks to socialise in a dialectical way the individual social activity with the activity of the whole of society. And in relation to this, there is a theory which Marx, I would regard as the most important of Marx's philosophical theories, which is Marx's theory of the fetishism of commodities. According to that theory, the problem of capitalism is that workers approach commodities without recognising the social history of those commodities, without recognising that the values which they confront in the marketplace are themselves the product of a history of social production. What I would argue is that in a broader philosophical sense, we can take that theory of fetishism and we can say that the values of a socialist society will be exactly the same. They will be the values of the recognition of the social history which has produced the world in which people live, the society, its organisation, production, distribution, and so on. In other words, it will be a value not based upon the imposition of one interest upon another antagonistic interest, but upon a harmony of interests and the recognition that what one person consumes, another has produced. What one person produces, another will consume. And they are as much a part of society together as they may in fact be separated during the course of producing and distributing wealth. And therefore I want to conclude by the second of those quotes, in fact, from Marx, which deals, I would argue, very well, although Marx would define the ethical problem in a different way to some extent than the way that I have defined it, it deals very well with how this harmonising of the individual with society has a place in the socialist proposition.
In what I may term a concrete ethic, self-sacrifice can never be more than an accident. The substance of such ethic consisting, as before said, not in the humiliation of self before God, but in the identification of self with humanity. At last, with the dawn of a new economic era, the era of social production for social uses, we shall have also the dawn of a new ethic. An ethic whose ideal is neither personal holiness nor personal interest, but social happiness, for which the perfect individual will ever be subordinate to the perfect society. The test of personal character will be here not self-renunciation in the abstract, but the possession of social qualities and the zeal for positive and definite social ends. This may be termed, in a sense, an absolute ethic. It is no longer naively objective like the ethic of the primitive world, when the individual was unconscious of possible interests apart from the community. And still less is it naively subjective, the attention of the individual being no longer primarily directed towards the mortification of self, but rather towards the broad issues of social life and progress. He will recognise the call of duty to do and to forbear only in things which directly affect the society, all actions not having a direct social bearing being morally indifferent for him. In this new conception of duty, the individual consciously subordinates himself to the community. This time not a community of kinship, but of principle. Not limited by frontier, but world embracing.